Welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program.
I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times.
This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and this is Listen to Older Voices and part one of a three-part program on the life and times of Mick Pacioli. Older listeners, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, may remember the Pacioli name from the 60s and 70s when Jack Pacioli hit the headlines in Sydney and then in Melbourne. Mick is Jack's son, and whilst this is the story of Mick, constant reference is made back to Jack for reasons that become very clear during all three parts. Born in 1955 in Woolloomooloo, New South Wales, Mick's family life, his father and mother to a lesser degree, his upbringing, all of them were anything but conventional. If you watched Underbelly, then you might have an inkling into Mick's early life. This is the story that may have been a plot for a TV series in itself, and it's all true. From his early life in Sydney through to having to escape to Melbourne without warning, to the strangest working relationship with his father and his own gang upbringing, we bring you a remarkable story. So settle back, learn and enjoy from the life of Mick Pacioli. Mick, it's an absolute pleasure sitting with you and talking to you, and thank you for being on Listen to Older Voices. And could I start by asking you, when were you born and whereabouts were you born?
Well, Rob, I was born on the 22nd of February 1955 up in Woolloomooloo in Sydney at St Margaret's Hospital.
The good old Lou.
Yeah, just behind the cross.
What would be your earliest memories then as a child growing up in that area?
Well, I didn't grow up in the cross. My earliest memory is a place in Blakehurst in Sydney. My very earliest memory, my first primary school, and I can remember a wiry little dog we had. But yeah, it's the earliest memory I've got. I was only there for kindergarten for 6 months. But
what do you remember about it then?
It was peaceful compared to what happened after that.
Well, I'm glad you got off to a quiet start at least.
Yeah.
You grin and you laugh when you say that. It sounds like your life exploded then after that. Well, what happened?
Well, we moved in with my father's parents and also sister, husband and children. So in this block in Matson Crescent, Miranda, we ended up three families in one block, but three buildings on the one block as well. A couple of bungalows out over Yowie Bay. And yeah, it was sort of like a big tribe. But I had an older cousin, John, who happens to be a good mate now, but he had learning difficulties and he was a torturous young bugger. And from then on, life got very strange.
So who was actually in your family? There was you, Mum and Dad?
And my two sisters.
And two sisters.
Two younger sisters, yeah.
What do you remember about Mum?
I think a typical Catholic lady at the time, drunk a lot and, you know, rather child abusive.
Right. And Dad? What was he like as a parent?
Invisible, mainly. He'd kidnap me occasionally just to annoy Mum.
Kidnap you? He wasn't living with you? Or you mean he'd just take you out of the family home?
He'd take me out of the family home. Like, you know, Mum liked to keep us all together. It was a bit different, mate. My father was a gangster in Sydney.
That's pretty unusual for most people.
Yeah.
Was he what we would call a hardened gangster or peripheral?
No, very hard.
Were you aware of this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to have to stand in front of my mother in the kitchen when the gunnies or the coppers had come running through.
Oh.
Dad'd be out the back window over the bay and gone.
Well, without asking for specifics, I mean, I've interviewed some people whose families were involved in SP bookies, some people who were involved in car stealing and things like this. Was that the type of thing your father was involved in?
I believe so. More theft, I think, or, you know, like handling of stolen goods, as well as any other, like, illegal gambling and other things, I'd imagine, that went on at the time.
Because it was fairly rife in Sydney in that period, wasn't it? I mean, if we can call it the gangster world, fairly, it was like Underbelly. It really was like that.
Well, indeed. The reason, a little bit further down the track it'll become evident, but the reason we live in Melbourne is because of a murder of a fellow called Jack Hodder and the revenge killings that took place after that. one of which was highlighted in Underbelly.
Right.
My father's bodyguard got machine gunned just before we moved to Melbourne. Barney Ryan.
This is pretty stunning stuff to listen to, I've got to say. Look, let's go back to you as a child. What sort of effect do you think that had on you? Obviously, you weren't like other kids around you.
No, and we weren't allowed to play with other kids because my parents were frightened that we'd get, you know, either picked up, nabbed, or used as ransom.
Right. So did that affect you having to go to school? Did you, you know, were you able to go to school or...?
Oh, yeah, but it was weird. We weren't allowed, you know, had to there and back and, you know, no parties, couldn't go to friends' places or anything like that.
So it was a fairly isolated existence for you?
To a degree. I had a couple of mates over the road. We used to go to war with the Protestants.
Oh, right, I forgot about that back in the 50s. Yeah. The Catholic
and coming Protestant. Home from school, yeah, the rock fights.
That's right, of course. Was school a positive experience for you?
No. I was well ahead of the game. I mean, they called me the professor at school in primary school because I knew the answer to everything. I was a huge reader at home because I had bugger all else to do. And so I knew all the answers before, you know, so my hand was always up. And so I got bashed for that too.
Oh, good.
It didn't help that my cousin had already alienated the whole school through his behaviour. And, you know, like, I remember my first day at Our Lady of Fatima in Caringbah, you know, coming out thinking, oh, right, I got my big cousin with me. To be surrounded by 10 blokes and have the
bejeebus,
you know, yeah, bejeebus kicked out of us.
Out of you. Oh, yeah. Well.
But then the nuns would attack you with canes and stuff on a regular basis, you know, to just keep you on the path of the righteous and stuff, you know, just look, torturous.
I was going to say it's like a very violent upbringing then.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you consider that, you know, like for some misdemeanour, you'll have been given six of the best by some crazy nun to get home with a note telling your mum that you'd been bashed by a nun only to get a couple of more around the head and told to wait till your old man gets home.
So he can have a go at you as well.
Yeah. It was a bit different for boys, I think, than girls at the time. Generally speaking, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but generally speaking, it was harder for boys.
Was this leash, if I can put it that way, that was attached to you for all the what might be appear to be the right reasons, was it ever slackened as you got a bit older, you know, as you became 7, 8, 9, 10, or was it just
no.
as tight? Always tight.
Always, always, always. Till we moved to Melbourne.
And what age were you when that happened?
I was 14, 1967, the year Richmond won their good flag.
And this is Listen to Older Voices. Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Mick Pacioli.
So the period from being a young boy up to this age of being 14 and moving to Melbourne, it was basically the same story the whole time, always being on a tether in case you were snatched and never really having much in the way of freedom.
Well, we weren't allowed out the front gate, but we had Yowie Bay as our backyard and for some reason or another, we were allowed to go anywhere we wanted in our boats. So we'd be rowing around, fishing, you know, like catching our own bait, rowing right up to the end of Port Hacking River and getting across into Audley National Park and, you know, doing discovery there. Yeah, we had great little business collecting bottles around the street and newspapers that we'd sell in bulk, you know. It used to fascinate me that kids would get out of bed early and run around in the rain to put newspapers in people's letterboxes for bugger all money. I had all my neighbours trained to flatten out all the newspapers for me, and I'd go around with my cart on a Saturday and pick them up and then go off to the butcher and the greengrocer and the fish and chip shop and sell them by weight and make enough money to go over and watch an Elvis movie at Miranda.
So you developed this self-sufficiency approach.
Yeah, as we got older.
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, 8, 9, 10... Yeah, it wasn't so much a matter of being allowed, a matter of them not being around either, especially on weekends.
Mm.
Dad was a bowler and Mum was a golfer and they were both right into their sport, you know.
Did it ever concern you that Dad was involved in these things or was it just part of your life?
Oh, well, you didn't really understand. You knew, but I mean, you didn't put two and two together that, you know, like you're sitting on the knee of Abe Saffron, for instance, you know what I mean? Like as a kid, it's... No.
It has a different meaning, doesn't it?
Yeah. You knew you were with a lot of men that carried big guns. Yeah, and I mean, they all carried guns.
So, at 14, what happened to create this situation where you came to Melbourne? Was it that you had to come to Melbourne or Dad chose to come?
Yeah, well, my parents had already left Sydney because of Barney Ryan's murder. They just vaporised. We hadn't seen them for a week. We were with our Auntie June up in Sydney. You know, they were looking after us.
Right.
And then one day we were dragged out of school in Caringbah, the senior boys' school, De La Salle Caringbah, is above the Our Lady of Fatima, Caringbah primary school.
Right.
My sisters were still in primary school, so I just remember being dragged out of class.
Literally?
Yeah, well, called out of class. Not dragged, but called out of class.
Right.
With the nuns, take me to my auntie, who's got my sisters with her. We jump in a car, head to Mascot Airport, I put on a plane and land in Essendon a couple of hours later. From there, we were picked up by Dad's bodyguard, driven from Essendon to Frankston for our introduction to Melbourne.
What did you think was going on? Did you know what was going on? Or were you confused?
Well, we had a fair idea. We'd just left Sydney for good.
Right.
You know, and there had been a lot of activity, you know, around Dad, Gunny's coming into the house looking for him and stuff.
Right.
After Hodder's murder.
So it was getting real serious at
that
point.
Yeah.
Did it upset you leaving? Did you leave friends
terribly
behind?
Terribly, mate. Terribly. I left my best mates behind. I spent a lot of time at home and in my interest in science and that. I was breeding guppies and live bearers and Siamese fighting fish. Had an array of tanks. I'd even developed my own strain of black guppy, lace tail, fantail, that I was selling back to the Caringbah aquariums. You know?
And that was all just left behind?
Yeah, gone.
Wow.
Finish.
Kids are very adaptable, and I guess because of their age, there would have been a degree of innocence about you. Did you find it easier to slot back into a life that quickly in Melbourne?
I went from an A-grade student, where I was the top of my class, virtually straight into the local street gang, carrying knives and guns myself.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is in Melbourne?
Yeah.
That's not what we would think of as the ideal upbringing for a kid, would we? Did Mum and Dad think that was okay, or they just didn't know? They didn't care?
No, obviously not, mate. That was their life. I mean, Mum obviously knew my old man was, you know...
Oh, of course.
Shifty when she married him. Then, you know, spawned me 9 months later.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I mean, they just lived their life, mate, you know? Jack was a musician originally, you know, he played trumpet from the age of 4.
In a band or just for his...
No, Bendigo marching bands. His father was the band leader.
Right.
In fact, I believe our family history tells us that Jack Pascioli Sr. led the first band touring out of this country to New Zealand. First international tour.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Right. So Dad inherited those genes from his dad and really took to it. What about you? Did you inherit any of that musical side?
I remember they tried to teach me guitar. They bought me a little Spanish guitar, you know, like a mini one, you know, and I'm sitting there and the teacher's trying to teach me blah, blah, black sheep and, you know, all this crap. I couldn't take it, you know. I wanted to learn Little Red Rooster and play the Nana, you know. And, you know.
Yes.
So I said, no, not for me. You can keep this thing. I don't like it. Yeah.
You mentioned before these things happening around the period of 1967. This was a fairly major point in your life where things really started turning around. In Australia, it was also a very interesting period, the 60s, particularly the middle to late 60s. There were lots of things going on. Were you, as a kid, sort of aware of the music world and how it was changing around you? Were you involved in that in any way?
Well, coming from Sydney, music was a very big part of our lives, the radio and all that. And I suppose different type of music to what Melburnians were listening to some degree. A lot of surf music, Deltones, you know, that type of stuff. Johnny O'Keefe was king, you know, and very potent and present in our lives, even though he was in the loony bin most of the time in my living memory, or dead. Yeah, music was huge for us, you know. I remember the first single I ever bought. I bought it for my sister's birthday. love child.
Diana Ross?
Yeah, and the Supremes.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
And you've tuned in to Listen to Older Voices, Turning Back Time.
Dad used to have these shops in Sydney, and they were like $2 shops that you see around now.
Yes.
But he had cigarettes in there that had usually fallen off the back of a semi-trailer, dry cleaning. They were called Safari, and anyone that lived in Sydney in the era would remember them. And he used to have me sitting out the front on the road up there in Sydney with a towel on my head, selling rugs out on the footpath.
You have to give him 10 out of 10 for imagination.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd go there on every Saturday for a bit of pocket money and sit there selling rugs, and that'd give me the job, and I'd be out there, you know, buy a rug, come and get a strip, whatever. Then at lunchtime, I'd go around the corner of this little Italian cafe and always play the jukebox and have a coffee and, you know, a toasted sandwich and self-motivated. And I just asked the bloke one day if I could buy the single off him, you know, Love Child, because, you know, the sister was very dear to me. He is very dear.
So how long did the street gang thing last for you? Did that become a major part of your life, or was it one of those things that you dropped into because of the changes in your life?
Well, it was weird. Myself and a friend from school were walking down the beach footpath, concrete footpath at Parkdale, heading back towards Mentone one day, and we got attacked by these two older boys, you know. We were 15, and these 19-year-olds just out of the blue started attacking us, you know. So we're bolting down the footpath. Then I look out onto, opposite the Mentone Hotel, there used to be like a storm drain.
Right.
Yeah, that went right out. Yeah?
Yeah.
And I could see my sister sitting at the end of this thing with this bunch of blokes. And I yelled out to Joanne, "Hey, Joanne!" Next thing you know, all this whole bunch of blokes have come running down this storm pipe and just like, give it to these two blokes that are chasing us. And from that day onwards, they said, Benny and Rudolph, you know, the two cousins, you're with us from now on, hang around with us.
And so you were in the gang.
Yeah. But look, wasn't so strange to have guns and knives back then, Rob. You know, I mean, I'd had a gun since the age of 7.
Yeah.
I mean, I was allowed to have my first gun at the age of 7. I had to wait till I was 7 before I could own a gun in Sydney. And it was a BB gun. You know, like just a slug gun.
Slug gun, yeah.
But, you know, like it was something that was a very big part of my life, shooting all through my life. You know, target shooting and, you know, like seriously dysfunctional hunting when we were young.
You mentioned shooting, and we're talking about now the late 60s. The Vietnam War was still going on. Were you ever old enough to be in the conscription for that?
Just out of it, and very happy to be out of it. I voted for Gough Baby.
It was a fairly turmoil period, though, wasn't it? There was a lot of anger in the community.
There was. This misfounded loyalty to the US and Britain, the want to keep on throwing our boys into, you know, the fray as cannon fodder.
Mm.
Yeah, I can see why people were getting a bit angry. A bit angsty?
Yes, it was, yeah. And it really split the community too, because, well, we've just got to go back and look at the moratorium march. I mean, there was a lot of people demonstrating against, but also a lot of people supporting it.
Yeah.
So you think that was a fairly major milestone for us as a country when Gough got in and sort of pulled the plug on all that?
It was that whole period, really, wasn't it? I mean, I reflect on it and think it was a bit like our summer of love, as they say in the States, you know, like that whole sort of, that 7-year period or whatever around that time, you know, it was when consciousness opened a bit more. People opened their eyes a bit more. They didn't take the blind dogma of church as their keen fodder anymore. They were listening and looking around. Maybe it was the acid, Rob. I don't know. I think it was the acid, personally.
Because whether people listening like it or not, drugs played a very important part for a particular age group, didn't it, at that period?
Well, particularly. And it was strange because we came after that period, I suppose, you know, growing up, you know, like when you're young, 1 year older than you is very old, you know. When you leave school, you know, like 10 years, 5 years, 20 years, I mean, you're just people, you know. Our little entourage, our cohort, I suppose, that group in Victoria at least, came after the period where you had the Mr. Asias and all that, the very, very deadly, insidious criminals, you know, the heroin dealers and all that, you know. What I found and remember very vividly from my period is the fact that people are into the grass, you know. They're into a little bit of acid and psilocybin. They're into broadening their consciousness, thinking more about ways of complementing each other rather than always wanting to be, you know, like defensive or on the attack.
You mentioned that you were a fairly good student. Then you came to Melbourne and things fell a bit apart in terms of the education side of things. So did you actually go into work of any sort?
Yeah, eventually.
How old were you?
Oh, well, I'd sort of been an entrepreneur most of my life. Even as a young kid, I was, you know, buying and selling and, you know, like trying to make a buck out of what I could, you know. But I suppose the thing about schooling, the fact that when I came to Melbourne, I was taken from the top of the, like from 2A in Sydney, where I was learning French and, you know, like the sciences and everything else, and I was put into 2D, where I was made to learn, you know, mechanical drawing and stuff like this, which was never going to become a part of my life, you know?
Sort of a dumbing down process?
Well, it's just the fact that it was an emergency move from Sydney and the brothers didn't have space in the top of the class. And, you know, maybe if I'd survived that year without getting involved in the street gangs, I might have, you know, like, made it into the highest class the following year. But, no, I totally lost interest in school.
So what filled that gap then?
Alcohol, fighting, playing pool in Mentone, around there. Yeah, I'd be out till midnight sometimes, unbeknownst to my parents, who were, you know, like often blind drunk anyway, or out.
Yeah.
Playing pool at the local pub or the local pool centre, you know, earning good money.
So that was the main source of income at that period?
Yeah, just pool. I could win $300 a day, Rob.
So it's very hard then for somebody to come to you and say, make something of yourself and you know, earn some money when you're earning more money in that one night than most people were earning in a week at that time.
Yeah. Finally, I'll never forget Broderick Smith burning in my ears as I'm driving down New Street. The last place that I want to be is home.
And that rang
a
bell.
It was playing, mate.
Yeah.
And I'm going, yes! Yes! Yeah, you won't see me for a while, Mum. But up until then, you know, I'd been a very good son, I suppose, from that point of view. You know, like I was the last to keep going to church, you know, but at 18 and a half, that was me. I bailed out of home and I wasn't coming back, you know. Yeah, I ended up in a flat on the corner of King and King and Victoria Streets, Melbourne, West Melbourne there, North Melbourne.
Right.
Yeah, called the Bantry. Yeah, fascinating times those.
What was fascinating about it?
Well, I'd sort of been kicking around the North Melbourne scene for a while in Essendon, and I had a group of friends that I'd sort of met post-secondary school. So I'd ended up at Assumption College after a few incidences. They sent me to boarding school, and when I'd returned from there, I'd met some people that were based in the north of Melbourne. So I started spending my weekends over in Ascot Vale, Mooney Pond, Nidri, you know, the Lincolnshire Arms Hotel was our favourite drinking hole Fridays and Sunday nights, for a couple of groups called the Dirty Dozen and the Magnificent Seven. Now, you'd think just names off the telly, but they're just party groups. 10 blokes and all their chicks, and you know, another 7 blokes over there who were sort of from down the road, but became this major party group. Instant party, invite the Dirty Dozen, and your kitchen's just packed.
So it was a good time.
It was. It was.
Do join Mick and I next week for part 2 of his story. More on his father's enterprising schemes and how the then notorious Toorak Times started with Jack Pacioli as editor and publisher. The stories keep coming one after another. So that's next week, part 2 of the story of Mick Pacioli. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.